on a bill concerning the war in Iraq, so that is why we're delayed. Thank you for your patience. We're going to start our hearing with House Bill 2624, public testimony. We have sign-in sheets. We intend to give 2 minutes per person, and we'll go back and forth between in favor and in opposition on this bill. We'll have the staff read the summary, and then we will go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2624, we heard Wednesday. Again, it deletes the annual adjustment of the minimum wage. Thank you.
Okay, and timing, 2 minutes? How much can we do? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. Okay, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2624. We will allow 5 minutes per person. We'll be timing it. We have 10 people signed up. Our first person will be Brent Detna. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Brent DeHart, actually. I'm a local small business person, and I represent the Oregon Gasoline Dealers Association. I'm a president of the association. Our association represents gasoline dealers, the retailers that service the public and its visitors. I'm here today to support House Bill 2624 and stand in solidarity with the Restaurant Association and Agricultural Committee and community and other retailers as an industry which is hampered and affected by the increases in the minimum wage. The gasoline dealers are struggling already, and our industry nationwide margins have been shrinking for about 10 years. So we're already in a situation of the mandated employment, and there are many dealers in our organization who are small business dealers and who are going to be affected. In my duties as president of Red Cross, dealers who have told me that they have no ability to pay more wages this year, and they are making up the difference in the increase with decreases in hours worked, an elimination of raises for people who otherwise would have earned them for time on the job or for increased responsibilities. Also, as a dealer myself, I have eliminated an educational benefit I usually offered to people who sought to increase their job skills and increase their ability to move up in their career. An educational benefit I used to offer freely to pay for half of their tuition is one of the ways that I have dealt with it as a small business person. Also, I'm covering far fewer people than I used to for health insurance. So in the case of benefits, either educational or health insurance, you know, or seeking out further responsibilities to get the raises, I found that it has had a tendency to flatten out the wage range at the workplace, that the people who are really in trying to achieve and move up and get a job a little bit beyond the entry level that we generally hire, it's become more difficult to do so. As I said, our margins have been shrinking for 10 years, so my fear is that with yearly increases in the minimum wage, we're heading for eventually a crisis that's going to be difficult for a small business to overcome. I appreciate the time to be here this morning. I wonder if there are any questions.
Okay. Committee, I am going to allow questions within the five-minute period that each person has, so are there questions? Representative Rosenblatt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your being here today. I would just ask you, though, I think consumers have seen really dramatic increases in the price of gasoline for their cars, and that includes the minimum wage workers that we're talking about. And since these annual cost of living increases are really a few cents that we're talking about, are you maintaining that the price of gas is somehow related to the increase that just happened in the minimum wage?
I wish it were, actually. Thank you for the question. We have been unable to build into, since minimum wage was $3.75, I've been a dealer since before then, any additional pennies in an average margin in the course of a year to make up for the difference in the minimum wage, we're seeing nearly doubling. And in 5 years, at a 3%, which is fairly conservative, a 3% cost of living increase, 5 years we'll be at $8 an hour. We're still struggling to get the same margins, the number of pennies per gallon that we were in 1990. So I don't know if that did that answer your question?
I'm just trying to clarify, are you maintaining that the price of gas is in any way related to the minimum wage, whether it stays the same or goes up. It sounds like from your testimony you have not raised prices based on the wage, but on other factors, I assume.
The current increases in the price of gasoline are related to the increases in the cost of oil and are not built into the price at this time. Any more so than they have been, which statistically, in Oregon, the price you have to pay a dealer, the dealer's margin, the difference between what we pay for and what you pay for, that margin is between 5 and 10 cents higher than it is in self-serve states. So the labor costs are about between 5, and most people estimate about 8, between 5 and 10 cents per gallon built in to cover labor.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. We'll go to Reverend Steve Witt.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Stephen Witte. I am the Executive Director of Oregon Farmworker Ministry. It is the position of Oregon Farmworker Ministry that the will of the voters in the November 2002 election should not be amended or changed by legislative action. HB 2624 and HB 2720 would do that, amend the will of the people of Oregon. It is our position that any legislative alteration of the voters' decision would produce egregious effects on the populace and economy. During this time of economic difficulties, it is the working poor who suffer the most. A large number of these workers are people of color or people without educational advantage. The current minimum wage forces the poor to rely on governmental and charitable resources to survive, i.e. food baskets, Medicare, and food stamps. Earning $6.90 an hour produces an annual rate of $14,352, far below the $28,845 needed by a family of four to meet the cost of living in Oregon. As we all know, our state has the highest incidence of food insecurity of any state in our country. And how odd that predicament is when we live in a state that's known for its agricultural superiority. Now is the time to heed the bold mandate of Oregon's citizens. By maintaining that mandate, we can greatly improve the lives of the working poor in our state. We can improve the self-esteem of those who have come to Oregon with the dream of bettering their lives. We will also be helping our struggling economy, as those workers are more likely to purchase needed durable goods through local merchants. After hearing Wednesday's testimony, I decided to check with a colleague of mine in North Carolina to check the accuracy of the testimony of a Christmas tree grower that spoke. My colleague there, Lori Kamala, told me that the farm workers in North Carolina are predominantly guest workers. North Carolina brings in between 20 and 30,000 guest workers each year. Then I checked with the USDA charts to see what the adverse wage rate for 2000 and 2002 was in North Carolina, as well as Michigan and Wisconsin, which are also mentioned as possible competitors to the Oregon Christmas tree industry. The USDA adverse wage rate for 2002 in North Carolina was $7.53. It was $8.57 in Michigan and Wisconsin. All three states are well above the $6.90 minimum wage rate that the voters passed here last November. Thus, the minimum wage of $6.90 in Oregon would not prove to be the financial disadvantage as was described for the Christmas tree growers in our state compared to those states that are claimed to be their major competitors. I have included copies of the USDA adverse wage rates for 2000 and 2002 as I've downloaded off the internet, and the citation for the website is included. It is imperative that we create and maintain an economic environment in Oregon that fosters the economic potential for all its citizens. We must create an environment that will encourage labor and employers to produce superior products and services whereby both can thrive and benefit. The people of Oregon made their will known last November. It is the democratic imperative that the legislature heeds the will of our citizens and work to make our economy more just and fruitful. I thank you for your time this morning, and I will entertain any questions.
Thank you. Representative Kitts and Gerard.
I'm going to be asking the same question of all testifiers as they come up. So if you'd like to, those of you that will be testifying, if you'd like to just answer my question without me asking it, that's fine. But my question is this. I'd like to know if those that testify, if you actually work for a business or you own a business.
I do not work for a business. And the executive director of an advocacy firm that speaks out on behalf of farm workers in our state.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard.
This kind of follows up on Representative Kitt's question. But how many people are employed by the Oregon Farm Workers Ministry?
Oregon Farm Workers Ministry?
Yeah.
I'm the only employee.
And what is your average hourly income?
I am working at a poverty rate.
I'm sorry, sir. What is your average hourly income?
I'm not an hourly employee. I'm a salaried employee.
Thank you. Other questions? 30 seconds. Okay. Representative Merkley, 30 seconds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the chart that you provided to us, it shows Oregon at 860, while other states might be as low as, say, 712. Why is the adverse wage higher in Oregon?
That's what the USDA establishes. That's the wage rate that must be paid to guest workers. Those are workers that are brought in from outside of the country for the sole purpose of working in a particular agricultural crop. We do not have guest workers to any substantial degree in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Reverend.
Thank you.
We'll go to Don Schellenberg and Barry Bouchot, Farm Bureau. Doug Kramer.
Madam Chair, if I may begin, I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. With me today is Mr. Barry Bouchot, President of the Oregon Farm Bureau, and on my far right, and I wanted to make sure both of those were on my right-hand side. I don't know if Mr. Kramer is more far right than Mr. Bouchot or not, but Mr. Kramer is on our Farm Labor Advisory Committee at the Oregon Farm Bureau, and they have comments they'd like to make today. Thank you.
Okay, we will allow 15 minutes, 5 minutes each.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Barry Bouchot, President of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I'm also a farmer in near Gresham, Oregon, raise berries and flowers. At the very least, this bill is about maintaining whatever economy we have left in the state of Oregon, and at the most, it is about improving Oregon's economy. Let me give you some real facts. The good news, according to the 2001-2002 Oregon Department of Agriculture and Fisheries Statistics, is that over the last 20 years, Oregon agriculture has had a steady growth in the gross receipts for farm products. The result is that we have put people to work on farms, in the processing plants, at farm supply businesses, in the freight business, in the wholesale warehouse, and in the retail stores. In 2001, reporting period showed that Oregon agriculture had an all-time high gross income of over $3.5 billion. The bad news is that the same report shows that the net profit for Oregon farmers in 2001-2002 was the lowest in 20 years. Why? Because the production expenses necessary to produce our crops, including labor, continues to increase faster than the prices we receive for our crops. What folks who testified in opposition to the bill on Wednesday haven't figured out is that agriculture does not, cannot, control the price of the commodities we sell. We cannot continue to compete with producers and states who pay federal minimum wage of $5.15 an hour while we pay $6.90 and more every year. We cannot continue to compete with producers in foreign countries who pay $6.90 a day while we have to pay $6.90 an hour. On Wednesday, a number of people were talked about the passage of Measure 25 not increasing the number of jobs. That was never the question. The question is, will it decrease the number of jobs? Time after time on Wednesday, you heard agricultural producers and business owners say, yes, it already has and will continue to decrease the number of jobs as the minimum wage increases. On my own farm, through attrition, we've lost employees in the last 4 to 6 weeks. We have not replaced them. At this stage, we will not be able to replace them. On Wednesday, you heard that the CPI increase is okay because it is relative to 60% of the workers who live up and down the I-5 corridor. I don't disagree with that, but again, that is not the issue. The workers are not the ones paying the labor bill that determines whether or not there will be a job for them tomorrow. The question is, can the agricultural producer pay the ever-increasing labor bill tied to that CPI increase? And the answer is no. On Wednesday, others tried to make the case that the voters knew exactly what they were doing when they passed the measure, including indexing, because the voters' pamphlet was very explicit, and everyone reads the voters' pamphlet. The polling statistics don't bear out that assertion. When the campaign began, the polls showed that 65% of the voters supported Measure 25. Those numbers continued to decline throughout the campaign, notwithstanding the voters' pamphlet, as the opposition finally got together a campaign that fully informed the voters. Had there been one more week in the campaign, polling statistics indicate that the measure would have failed. Finally, Madam Chair, on Wednesday there was testimony that the average yearly farm worker income is $7,500. It appears, according to Farm Worker Ministry, that may be twice that. The same report, which I cited earlier regarding the lowest net income for farmers in 20 years, also states that the average net income for farmers in Oregon in 2001 was $6,925, which is less than the yearly wage for the farm worker. When do farmers get a guaranteed minimum wage? Madam Chair, farmers are embarrassed that we cannot pay our workers more than we do. The problem is we have no choice. Not only can we not control the price of the commodities we sell, we cannot control the price of the inputs we must purchase to produce the crops and the jobs. We are price takers, not price makers. If Oregon wants agriculture to continue to be a stabilizing force in our state's economy, if you want us to continue to provide recreation opportunities and beautiful open space, then you must pass House Bill 2624. On the other hand, if you want to put most of the farm workers out of a job and pave over the Willamette Valley, then let this bill die in committee. Thank you for your testimony today. I'll answer questions unless you'd like to wait for Doug.
We'll do the full panel and we'll go to questions.
Yeah, my name's Doug Kramer. I'm owner-operator of Blue Horizon Farms out of St. Paul, Oregon. We handle cut flowers and berries, mainly blueberries, but some black caps, few grass seed crops, orchard crops. Have about 12 full-time employees that work with me, and then seasonal employees as I need them. I agree with Barry. It's embarrassing how low wages we actually end up having to pay our employees, and it's not because we don't want our employees to make money or that we don't have sympathy for our employees, but when we cannot receive a price for our commodities that can justify it, that makes us enough money so we can pay higher wages, I don't know where the money's going to come from. And that plays right into where this bill is headed. You know, we do give our employees annual raises. And what this bill is going to do is mandate the annual raise of the entry-level employee. And so it ends up squeezing our pay scale, which makes it much less of an incentive for our workers to do an efficient, effective job and get themselves to those higher pay rates, because now instead of giving them 25 or 50 cents an hour increase for doing a good job, we're going to be paying them 10 or 15 cents an hour, because the entry-level employees are going to take a lot of the dollars that I would have been funneling to those employees that actually are doing the work that should be rewarded for doing a better job. And I don't think it's fair, but that's what you're asking us to do. Again, we're a price taker, not a price setter. I compete with, in my cut flower operation, most other states in the union, Just came, I was at a national convention down in Georgia. Most of those southern states have blueberries from Florida, Georgia, Arkansas, the Carolinas. And all of them, their minimum wages are down closer to the federal minimum wage than where they are what I'm doing. And I directly compete against those states and those growers. And my labor cost is substantially higher than what they're paying. The way I'm going to have to make ends meet this spring is because I'm going to have increased labor costs, I now have to start cutting back on my fertilizers, my chemicals, and my other inputs into the crop. And I think there's a good chance that it's going to lower my peak production, but at this point I don't have a choice. I lay out a cash flow budget in January of every year, and it says I gotta lower my chemical and fertilizer costs to make ends meet. And so that's what I'm gonna be doing, and in combination with my salary range or my wage range is going to be compressed. My top guys are not going to get the increases they've been getting, and my entry-level guys are going to be getting paid substantially more. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in front of you. Wish I could give you better news, but that's the facts on my operation. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate it. How many minutes?
We got 6 minutes.
We have 6 minutes for questions. Representative Gallegos and Merkley and Girard.
Thank you for being here today. I would just like to follow on to Representative Kitts and Girard's questions they asked the previous panel, but ask you, what have you done in your lives to make sure that you, clearly you don't make minimum wage. You're trying hard not to, but what have you done in your lives to make sure that you're not making minimum wage?
Sure.
I'm assuming you've had continued education and...
I'm not sure of the depth of the question, ma'am, please.
Well, clearly you don't make minimum wage, but there were factors that you have employed in your life to make sure that you're not making minimum wage, and I'm just kind of curious, and I'm going to ask everybody this.
Increased production.
Yeah, I mean, the only offsetting factor we have on the farm...
I'm talking about you personally. I apologize, Madam Chair, that... I'm assuming that you have continued education in your life. You've received an education. You've worked hard and made sure that you are not always in a cycle of only earning minimum wage, right?
Well, that's correct. Me personally, I taught high school for 15 years, and I paid for that education by working on the farm. And that's what I was for a number of years. Was I worked on the family farm and was paid salary to do that. Most of the time it was less than minimum wage because my father didn't have to pay his son minimum wage. That's just the way it is. Sometimes I wasn't paid at all. But anyway, I paid my own way through university. I took up teaching high school for 15 years and came back to work on the family farm. And it's times like this that I sometimes wonder if I made the right decision.
Thank you.
Ma'am, I do make more than minimum wage. I pay myself a wage that I think is a fair wage for what I do, and as I pay all my employees a wage commensurate with their responsibilities and the work they put in.
Madam Chair, just a short follow-up.
We are limited in minutes, so
it's very short.
All right.
And I assume that you take all the risk for your business as well?
I do.
With that. Thank you.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little uncomfortable with us asking our witnesses about their personal lives, so I won't ask a question like that. But I do want to ask if it's really the principle of indexing that you're most concerned about, or is it the point at which the indexing starts? Now, I realize the bill is crafted to not affect the place where it starts, that is, leaving in place the increase, and then saying let's get rid of indexing. But the principle of indexing itself, that is, that instead of having a battle every 3 to 5 years over where the minimum wage should be, that we instead
index it to inflation, adjust it in very small pieces instead of creating great variations. Is it really the principle of indexing that is the problem, or is it that it's starting at a point that is too high for current economic conditions in Oregon, in your opinion?
Chair Close and Representative Merkley, I think the issue is multifaceted. The index that we have now is tied to urban index, and for most of rural Oregon that is irrelevant, because especially for agriculture, an indexation perhaps based on some kind of a something which was more realistic to agriculture may be more palatable. But I think the whole concept of indexation is automatic, forever, permanent increase based on nothing other than there's no fundamental basis by which you can assume that production increases on an indexation of that level automatically. It's kind of like the old frog story. If you put a frog in a bucket of cold water and stick it on a heater, it'll stay there till it dies. The death of a thousand cuts, you know, you decide to throw the frog into the boiling water and let him die instantaneously. Minimum wage does that. Indexation is the latter. In terms of our ability to continue our production based on some sort of artificial indexation is just impossible for us to achieve and to accomplish.
Mr. Broussard, yesterday I was told that the Smucker's processing plant in Woodburn was closing, costing 335 people their jobs. Are you aware of that? And if you are, what is the reason these 335 people no longer have a job?
Probably people are better to answer.
Well,
I've talked to them, but
I can answer some of that question, and I know there's other people in the audience that can. I actually deliver a fair amount of my products to Smucker's, so I'm very well aware of their intent to close their plant. They're going to have to come in and tell you what it's based on, but, you know, there's no doubt that in their peak season they have 300 plus employees during, I think, as full-time workers they have somewhere around the 60 to 70 full-time workers. So is it going to be another economic blow to Woodburn? Absolutely. Is there any change in their mind? I don't think so. What's it going to do to me personally in my farming operation? I have to go out and negotiate with other packers to sell my fruit, because Smucker's is no longer going to be here.
Thank you very much. We are out of time. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Our next panel, we'll call you up as a panel, Marcia Kelly, Tricia Smith, Kathy Eaton. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please proceed.
Chair Close and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. The coalition has been lobbying for 30 years on issues that affect Oregon women. Our members include the American Association of University Women, the Older Women's League of Oregon, Oregon Women's Political Caucus, Oregon Now, Delta Kappa Gamma, and the Salem YWCA. We also have individual members, and we represent every area of the state. We aren't just an up-and-down I-5 organization. In November, just 4 months ago, voters passed an increase in the minimum wage. The vote included an annual adjustment for inflation. This means that if the cost of living goes up, the minimum wage goes up. The voters of Oregon told Oregonians The voters of Oregon told Oregon that it was only sensible to have an automatic escalator in the bill. Yet today we're talking about House Bill 2624, which is an attempt to repeal the indexing. We think the voters of Oregon were telling the legislature they understood the premise that the minimum wage needed to be addressed with an index factor, and lawmakers didn't need to keep addressing the issue. Oregon voters have common sense. We think that's an underpinning of why we're not in favor of this bill. It only makes sense that as costs go up, so should the wages that are needed to live minimally. The stereotype of a teenager working to pay for clothes or CDs is far from reality. According to the Oregon Center for Public Policy, 73% of minimum wage earners are adults over the age of 20, 59% are women, and 25% are head of households. And most of those head of households, single-parent households, are women. Many families with a full-time wage earner are forced to live on a yearly income that is below the federal poverty level. These people do important jobs like care for the elderly in retirement homes and watch our kids in child care centers. They are single moms caring for their children by day, serving restaurant food at night. In short, they're real people trying to make an honest day wages. Yet they are forced to rely on food banks and government subsidies while working 40 hours a week or more. Putting a little extra money in their pockets can mean the difference between having to make those decisions: heat or eat, medicine or clothing, laundry, soap, or lunch money. Tough choices that no working parent should have to make day in and day out. An increase in their wages is a bonus for our economy. These workers spend nearly every penny of their wages right in our communities. They buy food from the local grocery store when they can afford it. They don't buy Disneyland vacations. They buy clothes and shoes for their kids. They don't fly to Paris when the rates are low. They pump more money into our local economy and small businesses throughout the state are helped because of that. By indexing the minimum wage, workers' wages keep up with the cost of living, and therefore families are better to afford basic necessities. Not indexing minimum wage results in this annual erosion of wages every year until it gets to the point that we again have to go to the voters for the common sense that is already included in the vote that they voted on last November. No one who works full-time should be forced to live in poverty. It's only common sense to index the minimum wage to inflation. Oregon voters have that common sense, and they used it in November.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Kathy Eaton, Government Chair of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization which encourages informed citizen participation in government and which provides voter education materials and activities. I speak today in opposition to House Bill 2624. One of the principal tenets of the League of Women Voters is that a goal of social policy, whether in Oregon or throughout the country, should be the promotion of self-sufficiency for individuals and families, and that the most effective social programs are those designed to prevent or reduce poverty. One of the goals in establishing a minimum wage with a formula for allowing it to increase as the rate of inflation increases is to provide a safety net for all those people working to move out of poverty. The minimum wage was never designed to increase jobs. Its purpose is to assist those who live on the edge of non-self-sufficiency, both as individuals and in families. There are thousands of Oregonians who work full-time and still live in poverty and whose children go hungry. We are painfully aware of the national statistics as they affect Oregon regarding poverty and hunger. Oregon is in a social policy crisis in terms of meeting the basic needs of its citizens. We certainly must establish programs to create more employment opportunities, but that must go hand in hand with doing whatever is necessary to prevent more Oregonians from sliding into poverty. The increase in the minimum wage passed by citizens last November and that law's ability to keep pace with inflation are very necessary to our state's responsibility for moving citizens out of poverty. The League urges you to abide by the vote of the people to provide for increasing the established minimum wage in a timely and reasonable manner through indexing annually. Do not pass HB 2624. Thank you.
Tricia Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good morning. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSCA members have asked me to come and testify before you today in opposition to House Bill 2624. OSCA has been an historic supporter of ballot measures increasing the minimum wage because my members are directly affected by the minimum wage. It hasn't been that long ago that they actually, some of them, made the minimum wage as their wages within schools, and all of them have wages that begin as a beginning point at the minimum wage and work up from there. So they have a direct interest in the minimum wage. They also have an interest in the minimum wage as it applies to all workers because they believe that it is counterproductive in our community to have workers working full-time who still need government assistance in order to provide for their families. It is a far more expensive way to go about things, to suppress wages and then require people to receive basic subsidies from the government in order to put food on the table for their children, in order to put housing over their heads, and education in their children's future. So we believe, my members believe, that it is very important that wages allow workers the opportunity to support themselves and their families. So we have been involved in the minimum wage for far longer than I've been involved with my organization. We think that it is inconsistent with good public policy to pass House Bill 2624 because we believe that it is good for business and workers to provide a stability and a predictability in the wage rate. Voters have shown that in good times and in bad, they support increasing the minimum wage when they're asked. Absent a cost of living index, they will be asked again and again and again as those wages fall further and further behind the ability to support a family. And we believe that those asks will be answered with a yes, as they have been time and again in Oregon. We think it is better for business and workers to allow the indexing to occur so that next year we know that those wages will not go up 50 cents an hour if there is a ballot measure, but instead will go up commensurate with the cost of living. That will provide workers with the opportunity to know how they're going to pay their rent next year or whether or not they're going to pay their rent next year in the job they have. It will provide employers an opportunity to plan for wage increases in a rational way rather than having to plan for them suddenly and significantly in an irrational way. We are very sympathetic to employers and industries that are suffering because of the downward pressure on prices brought about by the globalization policies of our country and the world. We are very sympathetic to that. We hear time and again from the people that have testified before you today that they cannot compete with third world countries because third world countries, as the previous speaker said to you, pay wages that no one can be expected to live on. We're sympathetic to that problem, but I submit to you that causing our workers in Oregon to suffer along with those third world country workers is not the answer to that problem. We will work with you to find those answers, but this isn't it. We believe that the minimum wage increase, as I said, provides stability to communities and to workers and to employers. And we know that the increases in the minimum wage will come back into those communities in which those workers live. We hope that you, while we understand and sympathize with employers in the concerns that they have in this economy, we don't believe that causing workers to suffer is the answer to those problems. And we would encourage you to leave House Bill 2624 in committee.
Thank you very much. 5 minutes? We have 5 minutes for questions. Representative Kitts.
I'm sorry, I don't believe you answered my question that I asked of all witnesses, so if you could just let me know whether you own your own business or you work for someone else.
Madam Chair, I really object to a line of questioning of the witnesses that asks them to disclose their income or their personal circumstances. We didn't ask questions like that of our witnesses on Wednesday, and I really think it's not the way we want to treat people in front of this committee. So I would just ask you to exercise some control over that.
I can rephrase my question.
Representative Kitts, why don't you rephrase it? I don't think we want to ask people's income. I think it may be appropriate to at least ask if they have their own business.
Okay. I was not asking for clarification to my vice chair. I was not asking income. I do agree with you. That is inappropriate, and I would not do that. So my question, again, is, I guess, do you sign the front of a paycheck or the back of a paycheck?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Kitts, as I explained at the beginning in introducing myself, I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I am their government relations specialist. They are a nonprofit public sector union.
Thank you.
So I am not a business owner.
Thank you.
I am a citizen volunteer.
Thank you.
I lobby for the Women's Rights Coalition, and in that position I sign a paycheck. I'm self-employed. I'm doing things only by appointment now. For the past 9 years, I signed the front of the paycheck for 3 employees and then 2 employees. The business that I was in was not impacted by the minimum wage. I own a travel agency. I was impacted by 9-1-1, the downturn in the economy, and the war.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you bearing with us. It is interesting to us to hear where various people's perspectives that they form on this issue as it relates to this issue.
My employees were women, and I paid more than the minimum wage.
Thank you very much. Okay, we have... Mike Townsend. Oh, I'm sorry. And... I'm having trouble reading this name.
Reyes Pena?
Yes. Please come forward.
My name is Mike.
Could you tell us your name again so we all the committee knows?
My name is Reyes Pena Martinez.
Gregas?
Reyes.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My name is Mike Townsend. I'm one of the owners of Townsend Farms. My brother also owns the other half of the business. We have a payroll of over $12 million. We're the largest grower and producer of fresh market and frozen fruit in the state of Oregon. I kind of want to embrace, to start off with, Republican Vallejos's, excuse me, Representative Vallejos's comment.
Both are true.
I started out in a farm family. I went to work at United Grocers when I was 21 years old. I worked at about $6 an hour. I have worked at many other jobs. I umpired baseball, and I got started in a fish company at basically minimum wage jobs. Humbly today, our business is growing to the point from about $500,000 in sales to over $58 million. To answer your question, I think that, you know, what we've seen is a sacrifice by our family to try to be tolerant and to try to look at our employees' wages and the growth of our company at the same time. I think that we've worked hard at trying to stay in business. We're one of the only ag businesses that's been able to survive in ag. We've suffered through 4 bankruptcies, Flavorland Foods, Carriage House Foods, New West Foods. All have been Oregon-based companies and all are no longer in agriculture or producing agriculture products for the grocery stores, which is what our company does most of. We do polybag fruit. We also supply industrial products to people like Smucker's. My son Billy also does fresh market. I want to add that I make $115,000 a year. I started out at about $27,000, and in my 7th or 8th year, my dad said I could have a raise to $40,000. There's been years where we spent our profits on dairy flats. There's been 5 years of fighting our neighbors to put in labor housing. We spent $1.8 million on labor housing. this is an emotional subject for me because we spent almost $250,000 in legal fees. So I'm a little bit, you know, I'm passionate about it because we believe in taking care of our workers. We have ministers that come in and give Holy Communion on one side, and we have another, although they're labor housing, we have another group of people that come in and minister to our people. We house over 800 Hispanics, and we've spent $1.8 million in housing. And so we have taken the money out of our back pocket to try to give our people a safe place to live. We spend $22,000 every year on protection of those people. We have prostitution. We have illegal sales of alcohol, drugs, and contraband that's come into our housing facility over the years, and we've negated that completely, and we haven't asked for $1 from our state. Nor did we ask for $1 from our state for our housing. But we do have to pay $250,000 because of our neighbors not wanting us to have housing for our Hispanics, our Hispanic workforce. I mention all these things because I think it's necessary to understand that we are in a world economy. Our company spent $5 million. I want to repeat, we spent $5 million on creating crops that would pay a higher minimum wage, which are blueberries, which was what my son markets. Most of our people in strawberries and blueberries make in the $8 to $8.50 range. Although, to be competitive, we need strawberries to cover our overhead. We process 9 million pounds of strawberries. We can't really compete with third world countries in that respect because they have a lower minimum wage, so we're losing our overhead absorption in strawberries. So that's kind of a challenge for us. I hope you understand that I hope that we can both come together as a group and have communication to understand why it's necessary to keep farm families in business. I think that we have a great state, and we have some tremendous opportunities if we can work together so people can understand, you know, our actual issues are not against one another, but together collectively trying to understand the world market. To answer the question about Smucker's, the reason that they pulled out of the market, because they no longer need to fight in a world market against juice concentrate that comes in from the third world. Also, they own Jif and Crisco now, and those types of things that they use for overhead absorption, they don't need to participate anymore. I will say, though, that they did have a intense labor negotiation, and they were trying not to pay any more wages than what they were paying last year at this time. I don't know if that answers your question, but the actual issue is that the world market has negated a lot of our juice concentrate companies in Oregon. There's about three of them. There's two of them that have also gone bankrupt in Oregon in that respect. At this point in time, I don't have really anything more to say, and I want to work together with both sides, and I truly respect both sides.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Gregus, is that correct?
Yes.
Welcome.
My name is Reyes Peña, and I've been here in the United States since 1969, and I come to Oregon in 1972. Myself, I've been a farm laborer and working to a food processor like AgriPack, working 18 years. I was chef steward for the Teamster when Mr. LBJ was alive. And I went through a strike, and I remember Mr. LBJ doing negotiation with AgriPack, and the team AgriPack say, we need to survive. If we frost our wages to the people. Now AgriPack is gone. And I'm working for Thompson Farm as a field man and as a plant manager on Woodburn. And I deal with 150 farmers, small farmers. And I've seen a lot of farmers going because they cannot afford the cost of living, labor. There's a community of Russian farmers that they're leaving to Minnesota because they're looking for a better living because the cost of living is so high over here. And that forced a lot of farms to close. And we're going to lose jobs. I've seen for the last 13 years working as a Townsend farm, a migrant. People come from California, Texas, Mexico, 13,000, 15,000 to do the harvest. And they're decreasing because the acres of harvest are gone. And part of the problem is because the increase of cost of living.
Thank you.
How much time?
2.5 minutes. We have 2.5 minutes for questions.
Can I mention one thing real quick I forgot to say? And I want to be able to answer this question for everybody on both sides. At 690, we have a lot of husbands and wives working on our processing plant. We employ 250 people year-round. I'd say 200 of those people are probably at 690. It impacted our company by $500,000. So I know this isn't the answer, but husbands and wives are making $28,000 a year because they're working for us. I came out of Michigan yesterday on a sales trip, and one of my competitors is Peterson Farms. I buy fruit from him. We buy annually. We're the largest buyer of blueberries probably in the world. We buy 8 million pounds of blueberries. Peterson Farms minimum wage is $5.50 an hour in Shelby, Michigan. I'm not advocating that. I'm proud that we can pay more than they're paying. But at the same time, I'm a little envious of the fact that I wish there was something that would lend it to where we could be on a little bit more level playing field with them. I did notice that they're a lot larger company than we are. I did notice the repack facility, and I did notice some of their competitors' products in their freezer. I get paid to kind of look at the little things, and one of the things that I'm concerned about is that me going back to the people I sell to, which is Kroger's and Safeway, and asking for more money and to stay in business, we need to look at those issues, and I hope that both sides will look at that as an issue. Any questions?
We are out of time. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate you coming. Josh?
Jeff?
Excuse me. Jeff?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Sugarman. I'm a part-time registered lobbyist, and I also worked on a campaign to pass Measure 25. I come here today to give you a little bit of background on why I believe the initiative passed and why I believe it's wrong for the opponents of Measure 25 to be here today seeking its repeal. One of the main arguments I've heard from both the proponents of 2624 and legislators who support them is that voters didn't really understand the indexing. I submit to you that's just plain wrong. The opponents of Measure 25 spent nearly $300,000 on advertising to defeat the measure, about three times more on advertising than we spent. They were on radio, they were on TV, they sent out direct mail, and in every one of those ads, they talked about the indexing and how they opposed it. In every editorial board visit that I was in, the opponents said, it's not the 690 we oppose, it's the indexing. And in four of their six voter pamphlet arguments, they referred directly to the indexing. So voters clearly knew about the cost of living adjustment, and yet they still chose to pass this initiative. True, it was close. It passed in 30 House districts. It passed in 16 Senate districts. In fact, it passed by nearly the exact number of votes that Governor Kulongoski defeated Kevin Mannix. And yet I see no one here claiming that election should be overturned because it was close and because people didn't understand the issues that were at stake there or because they needed one more week. We heard testimony earlier today that polling indicated that initially the support for the minimum wage was 65%, and that's true. Historically, initiatives pass in this state because they start with support in the mid-60s, and historically, it's the amount of money that's spent to drive down support that is the key factor in whether or not an initiative wins or loses. Like everyone else, the opponents of Measure 25 knew when the election ended, and they lost. And now they're coming here today and asking you to undo the will of voters. This bill is about one thing and one thing only, taking future wages out of the pockets of workers and placing it directly in the wallets of businesses and restaurant owners. It's not about economic development. For as Joseph McKinney, a business owner who testified in opposition of 2624 on Wednesday, said, a healthy working class is essential to our economic recovery. I was here on Wednesday, and I was frankly appalled at some of the testimony. I heard an NFIB representative say that businesses are in a survival mentality. will join the club facing minimum wage workers every day and every month for the last few decades. Members, low-wage workers are always in a survival mentality. They face the same increases in fixed costs like heating and gas and food as restaurant owners and businesses. They can't control the prices of food, gas, medicine, or anything else that they have to buy every single month. We heard a regional manager from a national restaurant chain get up here and say this indexing would hurt their company dramatically. He then went on to say his chain had opened 35 stores in Oregon in the last few years. He is paid to do, is worried about his company's bottom line, about the profits that allow him to buy $250 suits and Italian loafers. And I say that not to suggest that he doesn't have the right to do that, but to show you the disparity in the lives of managers and of minimum wage workers. Meanwhile, we have testimony from daycare provider and single mom Tyra Lynn, who testified she's forced to go to the food bank every month and to dig through dumpsters to find recyclable cans and bottles just to afford diapers for her kids. There's a document circulating around the Capitol by the Grocers Association that says we're already losing jobs because of the rise in the minimum wage, completely ignoring the fact that unemployment rises virtually every year in January because businesses in the retail sector lay off their Christmas help. The truth is that the restaurant and service sector is one of the only areas of our economy that has increased jobs over the past few years, and they've done so consistently. The proponents of this bill are asking you to repeal a portion of a voter-approved law that has never taken effect. We are facing an economic crisis in this state, but it is not due to the increase in the minimum wage, and it's certainly not due to the indexing provisions of Measure 25. I urge you to vote no on House Bill 2624, and I thank you for your time. And in anticipation of Representative Kitt's question, let me tell you a little bit about, I am a self-employed, I have been self-employed for the last 12 years. I work part-time in the field of politics. I also work part-time at $10 an hour over at Willamette University in the athletic department. I also coach a basketball team at my son's middle school where I get paid $500 a month. Being a self-employed person, I often contract with other people and I pay them well above the minimum wage. So I come from this on both sides of the coin. I'm also a single dad with primary custody of my son. So I think I've seen it from both sides, and I really do believe that that the voters knew what they were doing when they passed Measure 25 and that we should uphold their will.
5 seconds.
I'm sorry, we're out of time. Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, our last speaker is Mark Simmons, former Speaker of the House. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for giving me this opportunity to come forward and address you on this subject that has been before you the last couple days. I am the Government Relations Coordinator Director for the Oregon Association of Nurserymen. It's a trade association, and I'm one of the folks that helps try to make things happen on behalf of that organization. To Representative Gallegos' comments earlier, I started out my first summer in Oregon, worked all summer for a bread heifer, hauling hay in the fields all day long. Worked the next couple summers for $1.25 an hour, hauling hay, when the minimum wage, if memory serves me correctly, was $2.11, and quickly learned that if I wanted more money, I needed to learn to add more value, and started going to school and taking night classes, driving an hour and a half one way for a three-hour class, 6 hours, to get back home and try to better my lot in life. It was very difficult, but I'm happy that I did it. The prior panels have described for you the pressures that agriculture is under, both domestic and international market competitions dictating to farmers and agriculture today what they can do with their land and what they can produce profitably. Regardless of those pressures, the nursery industry has been the shining star of Oregon agriculture, with more than almost $700 million of annual farm gate wholesale business, employing more than 20,000 workers, that's Oregonians, who are working, doing the jobs on these farms today, and making a very critical contribution to Oregon's economy during this recession. The markets are down a little bit, but not near as dramatically as in some sectors of our economy. In spite of that, there are some very threatening realities that this industry deals with daily, realities that cannot be changed. by the businessmen in the business. 80% of what we grow is exported out of state. Our major markets are on the East Coast, and you combine cost of production with $4,000 average per load in freight costs to get your goods to market, and it threatens to put us in a non-competitive position in relation to our competitive states. Our primary competition comes from Ohio, Tennessee, and the Carolinas. Minimum wage in those states is about $5.15 an hour at the federal minimum. They can get their goods to market a lot cheaper than we can. Growers in Ohio, it costs them about $1,700 a load to get their goods to the East Coast markets. Tennessee, it costs about $1,800, and Carolina is about $1,100. That same desire to find a product that can be produced and employ individuals and have an enterprise going on has encouraged farmers in New Jersey to plow up their potatoes and put in nursery stock. Growers there are providing free delivery within 150 miles. Smaller minimum orders. They don't have to fill a truck with 8,000 one-gallon cans to get it delivered to their farm. We have growers that are competing head-to-head with those growers where their competition on the East Coast is delivering for free. But we've been able to compete because here in Oregon, we grow a better crop. We produce a better product and are proud to do so. This is a discussion before you and a decision for you about what kind of Oregon do you want? What kind of future do you want for Oregonians? In spite of our best efforts, in spite of the best efforts of the farmers, if this bill does not pass, the nursery industry in the state you have today will not be the same 10 years from now. The jobs will be gone. Those 20,000 jobs, many of those jobs will be gone to Ohio, Tennessee, the Carolinas, or even New Jersey. We have to preserve agriculture's ability to operate in the state of Oregon. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much.
80 seconds.
We have 80 seconds. We have time for 80.
40
seconds.
Madam Chair,
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Doing some quick math in my mind, I think even if this doesn't pass, that those nurseryman jobs may be gone. Due to the cost of transportation and your competitors' proximity to the market. Am I correct in that possibility coming true?
There are always possibilities of declining market share, and it's a reality that's dealt with every day. And growers are doing their utmost to make sure that they stay in the market, and we do produce a better product. We do produce a better product in Oregon, a more consistent product and a better product.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We are out of time.
Thank you very much.
That concludes our witnesses on House Bill 2624. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2624. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2624. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move that House Bill 2624 move to the floor with the due pass process.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2624 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? I know we'll have a lot, so try to keep your comments to 1 minute each if you could. Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm the sponsor of this bill, and it greatly upsets me to sit here and to have heard that those who oppose this bill see this issue as only trying to deny someone the opportunity to feed themselves or their family. It really distresses me. I wish with all my heart that every worker could earn a livable wage in this state. But I know a few businesses that wouldn't want to pay a livable wage if they could afford it. This bill addresses a problem and offers a solution. I have not heard any opponent of this bill offer any other possible solutions. The high minimum wage in Oregon is only one of the factors that contribute to our continued economic downturn. And this bill simply offers a solution to one of those problems. It is only a partial solution, but Madam Chair, that's why I will vote in favor of this bill.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm somewhat taken by surprise that we're doing a work session on this bill today because I had just seen an agenda that showed it posted for a work session on Monday. However, that is where we are. I am extremely troubled by this bill, and I respect Representative Garrard a lot, but I have to say freezing wages in perpetuity, which is what this bill proposes to do, is not a solution to low wages or to business development or any of the other problems that have been talked about over the past 2 days of hearings here. You know, the last two times the minimum wage went up in Oregon were in 1989 by an act of the legislature and in 1996 by an act of the voters. And each of those times, the wage went up from starting at $3.35 to $3.85 to $4.25 and to $4.75, and after that to $5.50, $6, and $6.50. And those increases were much larger than the increases that this bill proposes to delete. The state of Washington, which enacted indexing, just raised their minimum wage by 11 cents an hour. And I'm concerned that businesses who are testifying against this are really inviting a backlash from voters if this were to pass that would create those large increases again, which I think will be much harder to absorb than the ones that voters said they wanted when they passed this in November. Having said that, I think that we're proposing here to delete something that hasn't even taken effect, hasn't had any chance to have an experience in Oregon, and all sorts of predictions of disaster from this are really not based in anything in reality. Beyond that, I think the message we're sending both to the voters, but even more so to the working people of Oregon who are struggling very hard right now to get by on wages that have barely gotten above poverty level right now, is that we really don't care what voters said in November, and more than that, we don't care that workers have enough to feed their families. I think that's the wrong message to be sending, and I will be voting no on this bill today.
Thank you. Representative Kitts.
This bill, and I agree with Representative Rosenbaum, it's a tough bill. My colleagues on this committee, I respect immensely. I've been undecided where I stand on this bill up until this point. And I will tell you that in large part of the testimony of Billy Townsend yesterday, I think we're seeing a passionate plea from those folks in our state that employ everyone else, saying for economic reasons this is not good. I was elected by my constituents to come here and get Oregon back to work. It's for that reason, and the testimony that's been presented before me and this committee today, that I will vote yes on this bill. I will support this bill on the floor. I have reservations about overturning the will of the people. Grave reservations. But when empirical data is presented to us as the legislature, it is our job to act, to lead. I'm very comfortable with my decision. I will support it. And I have yet to prove, or excuse me, I have yet to have been proven to me that if we were to raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour or $20 an hour, that it would help the economy in Oregon. And until that's proven to me, in this economic time, I cannot support it. And it saddens me, because I want everybody to make a living wage. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Representative Schaffer.
I want to answer Representative Kitt's question. I grew up in a rural town in Iowa, and I frequently, too, worked for less than minimum wage with a lot of my boyhood friends, family farms. And a lot of my friends are pork and grain producers. Well, they're not pork producers anymore because of the huge world market and some folks out there that have control of the packing industry, they don't even buy their hogs. The Morlums that I grew up with, Virgil Morlum and his family, they frequently went to the State Fair of Iowa and got blue ribbon, first place with their Hampshire, purebred Hampshire hogs. Virgil quit raising purebreds because it cost too much money. And after a while, he couldn't even find a place to take his hogs to market. Now, these folks didn't get out. And I assure you, I do have great sympathy for the American farmer. Both my grandfathers were dairy farmers. My uncle and my cousin still are. The minimum wage is not what drove the Morlums out of raising hogs. Minimum wage is less than Iowa. Now, I'm not an expert in your industry, and I don't claim to be. But you know what's happened? These world market forces that have nothing to do with how good people or good hard workers you all are or your laborers are controlling this and driving people out of business. And where I grew up, minimum wage had absolutely nothing to do with it. And I think these forces are pitting people against one another that I hate to see. Now, I want to look you two gentlemen right in the eye and tell you I'm going to vote against this. I'm going to vote no for this. I that it's not because I believe you're bad or you're not treating your labor well. It looks like you are. I have no reason not to believe you. But I think there's forces here that are far greater than our minimum wage laws here in Oregon that are really causing it. That's what I think. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But I want to look you in the eye and say I'm going to be voting no on this.
Thank you very much. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I found it interesting to hear about Smucker's going out of business. When I was in sixth and seventh grade, I got up at 4 a.m. and got on the berry bus to go out and pick in fields that provided berries to Smucker's. I don't know if they own them, but we would sing a song about Smucker's on the bus, spelling out the name, and Smucker's grows the very best was the basic line of it. And so I'm kind of nostalgic that they're gone. The minimum wage discussion causes great polarization. Those who work with those who earn minimum wage and see the challenge of living on that amount create a portrait of affluent corporate leaders wanting to put a little more in their pocket at the expense of their workers. And industry comes out and says that they take good care of their workers and that this is about growing the economy. And I don't think either of those portraits presents a full picture of the close partnering that occurs in an industrial undertaking. You need to have good workers and you need to have good employers. And we would probably all be pretty clear if we were talking about a huge leap up or a huge leap down that was out of the range of the reasonable, and we're wrestling kind of within the where within that middle range is the reasonable place. And I had hoped that indexing would be in many ways a peace treaty between these episodic debates where we are pitted on one side or the other. Because it seemed to me that small increments create a lot less shock to the market, and we don't go through this process of each side demonizing the other. That's why I asked the question earlier about whether it was the principle of indexing or it was really the height at which the indexing was starting. Because I like the idea of having a stable, predictable wage, a wage that adjusts for the poor to be able to address a little bit of the cost of living. That makes sense to me. There was a book that came out last year called Nickeled and Dimed, Just Getting By in America. It's a very interesting book where a woman goes out and attempts to work minimum wage jobs in Florida, in Maine, and in Minnesota. And when you read that book, you realize that any of us who tried to go out and live on minimum wage without a lot of things stacked up on our side would be in a really hard place to do it. So I hope that indexing survives, and I hope that we find that it is a contribution to a stable and predictable economy that brings workers and employers closer together. I don't know if that will be the case, but I think it's an experiment that we should go with, and I'll be voting against this bill today.
Thank you, Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's important to note that, or maybe we didn't see enough of it, but there's a lot of factors that go into why some people are stuck in a cycle of only being able to qualify for a minimum wage job. Many of those might be age, experience, their skills, their education, just the lack of other opportunities that came their way, or there are other factors that are completely out of their control or our control. You know, bad things happen to people, but I can't see that an automatic increase every year, which has a detrimental effect on the employer's ability to continue to keep people employed, actually solves those problems. I think things like the Parents of Scholars program helps to solve those type of problems. I think we need to make strong investments in other programs to help people get a good education and end these cycles of poverty. But I think in the meantime, our economy is struggling. We heard from many of our employers who are planning a year in advance and are trying to struggle right now to stay employed so we can keep people busy working, and I hope that we can work for other solutions that will help end the cycle of poverty, but I hate to see us throw so many business owners who have been employing so many people. The list of all the bankrupt businesses, that clearly there are people who are unemployed and looking for other work. I think it's the right thing to help our business owners who are trying to create jobs, stay in business, because Oregon's going to be in a really sore shape here if we continue to see this huge decline, and I think then we'd have other greater problems facing us here this next year if we continue in this cycle without acting. That's all, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all the members' comments. I know you all feel strongly about this, and there's no doubt in my mind that you all want to truly help people. But I do want you to know I've taken up this bill because as state representatives and senators, we have the authority to repeal and amend current law. We saw it under Measures 45 and 50, and I think that people were largely pleased that we did revisit that, and we did try to make it better. And we can argue about that all day long. But we do have the authority to repeal and amend current law, and that's what this bill would do. I also believe we have the responsibility and the obligation to act when we see something devastating that is about to happen here in Oregon. And I am convinced that that is the case. We operate in a market system where price is determined by supply and demand. We have to look at the bigger picture. It was Karl Marx in the Communist Manifesto who said that government should control the factors of production, like wages. The former Soviet Union today, if you look at them, farmers stopped producing, the economy failed, and now that group of nations are third world nations. And we have to look at that. We have to look to the future. I believe we must act to avoid massive job layoffs and massive loss of Oregon businesses. And that is our opportunity today to do so. So thank you very much. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
No.
Representative Shockley?
No.
Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Chair Close?
Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Gerard will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2624. Thank you all for coming and for your comments.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3010. Our first presenters are Jeff Carlson, Bob Shiprack, and James Watts. Please come forward. Committee, we have a number of people to testify on this bill. We're going to do the best we can to manage it. By 11:20, we intend to go to the work session on the other two bills. And the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3010 requires the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules conforming to federal regulations relating to the erection of steel. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for your patience. We had a long dissertation and an important one.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Jeff Carlson. I represent 1,200 members of the International Association of Bridge Structural, Ornamental, and Reinforcing Ironworkers, Local 29. Our jurisdiction includes the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington. I am here today to urge your support of House Bill 3010. And Madam Chair, I'd just like you to know that I've got some of my members here today. They're in the crowd in support of the bill. If you'd all like to raise your hand so the committee can see, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you all for coming. I imagine some of you had maybe had to take off work, and we appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is important to note that I am a member of Local 29 and have been since 1973. The majority of my involvement in the trade has centered around steel erection. I have erected steel in Oregon, Washington, California, Utah, South Dakota, and New York. I have worked on countless projects for many different employers under all kinds of conditions. The conditions I am referring to today are those that relate to safety. The Federal Steel Erection Standards, commonly referred to as SENRAC, which stands for Steel Erection Rulemaking Advisory Committee. This committee, made up of stakeholders and Federal OSHA, came up with proposed rule changes. Federal OSHA adopted many of the recommendations from SENRAC, effective January 18, 2001. The SENRAC proposal, 29 CFR Part 1926, subpart R, Safety Standards for Steel Erection, Final Rule, is the most comprehensive step in protecting ironworkers engaged in steel erection to date, and in my opinion, long overdue. It has been very frustrating for ironworkers to endure some of the safety requirements imposed on us by individuals that are not directly involved with steel erection. For example, Oregon OSHA has proposed fall protection rule changes to subpart R and M to a uniform 10-foot trigger height for all construction workers. Oregon OSHA's reasoning is that uniformity will be easier to understand and enforce. Safety regulations should be designed to protect workers. They should not be designed for the convenience of Oregon OSHA compliance officers. Fall protection requirements for plumbers and electricians and other trades can be hazardous to iron workers erecting steel. Oregon OSHA has gone against the industry by amending federal steel erection standards. These changes have created an unsafe work environment for ironworkers erecting steel. Oregon OSHA has ignored the findings of SENRAC and made a mockery of the rulemaking process. In late January 2001, I met with Oregon OSHA Deputy Administrator David Sparks to inform him that Ironworkers Local 29 planned to introduce legislation that would require that agency to adopt the new federal steel erection standards commonly referred to as SENRAC. I explained to Mr. Sparks that Local 29 has support of the Northwest Ironworkers Employers Association. Mr. Sparks convinced me that it would be best to make changes through the rulemaking process by forming an advisory committee. Mr. Sparks explained that the advisory committee would be made up of stakeholders, and of course Local 29 would be part of the process. I agreed with the understanding that the Northwest Ironworkers Employers Association would also be at the table. The Oregon OSHA Steel Erection Advisory Committee was made up of three separate groups. Group 1 was comprised of the Northwest Ironworkers Employers Association, Local 29, Oregon Building Trades Council, and an open shop steel erector. Group 2 are general contractors Hoffman Construction and Baugh Construction, and Group 3 was Oregon OSHA. The first meeting was May 3, 2001, the second meeting June 6, and the third meeting July 7, 2001. At this third meeting, Deputy Administrator David Sparks said that Oregon OSHA will adopt CENRAC but keep a close eye on accidents and fatalities, as noted in the July 7, 2001 minutes. I had distributed to the committee earlier a packet with 10 exhibits, and those are the references that I'm making now. Mr. Sparks went on to say there is no need for public comment or for this group to meet again. Those remarks are not reflected in the minutes. No one expressed any opposition to what Mr. Sparks had said. I reported to the membership at the next union meeting, and everyone was elated that finally something was done for our welfare on the job. It was great news. On September 25th, things started to change. At a meeting of the partnership committee, on page 3 under exhibit 4, on page 3 under steel erection, Al Arguedas, safety coordinator for Baugh Construction, said he could not endorse Oregon OSHA supporting the fall protection heights. Others agreed. Mr. DeLuca brought up a uniform standard for all construction workers. I've always contended that part of the reason some of the general contractors have a problem with this bill is they have a very stringent safety program that exceeds the state standards. And if they're competing with, I'll take example, if you can allow me a little latitude here, Representative Schaffler is a general contractor with a 6-foot trigger height, and Representative Merkley is a general contractor that utilizes the state standards. And I'm a steel erector, and both of you are competing for the same project. If I am a steel erector, I'm quoting a different price to each general contractor based on their safety requirements for that project. So Representative Schaffler, with a more stringent safety requirements, is going to be looking at you as a threat because Representative Merkley, because you have an unfair advantage because your standards aren't like mine. So this 10-foot across the board kind of levels the playing field. If I have to bid to Representative Schaffler at the 6-foot and you at the 10-foot, my price is going to be the same because there's not that much difference. And the reality is that the ironworkers will be tied up pretty much 100% of the time, which is a detriment to their safety. So what I'm asking you to focus on is just make sure what the motives are on those that oppose this bill. I'm a second-generation ironworker. My brother John's an ironworker. My nephew Mike's an ironworker. My son Jake's an ironworker. And our motives are about safety. October 2nd, 2001, and nobody will ever admit that, what I just told you, except for, I think this will be quite telling, October 2nd, 2001, the first meeting of the newly formed Construction Advisory Committee convened. Exhibit 5. It is apparent that DeLuca is leading the discussion to adopt a 10-foot across-the-board trigger height for all construction workers. On page 3, the sixth paragraph, Mr. Strickland states, "In construction, the low bidder gets the job. If you are looking at the same standards, the bids will be more alike." It's not about the bidding, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's about safety. It must be stressed that no one from the steel erection industry was a part of this committee. The Steel Erection Advisory Committee was informed by DeLuca that there was a groundswell of opposition in regards to the 15 and 30-foot trigger heights in the federal rule. DeLuca scheduled a meeting October 19, 2001. At the meeting, both the Northwest Ironworkers Employers Association and Local 29 expressed frustration over what was unfolding. Both sides reiterated their support of the federal rules. DeLuca said he had planned to hold public hearings on the matter. This is a departure of what was said July 25, 2001. On December 5, 2001, the Construction Advisory Committee met under item 6, fall protection, this committee acknowledges that the industry wants the federal rule. In looking at the entire paragraph, I interpret the last sentence to mean that they needed to get people there in opposition to the federal rule. And I'm going to flip to that, and what I'm going to read you now is minutes produced by Oregon OSHA. It's item 6. The rule on fall protection that Oregon OSHA will be proposing is what the industry wants. Hearings will be held at the end of January in Portland and Eugene. People are encouraged to attend and provide testimony. Discuss what can be done to ensure the proper attendance at these meetings. Now, when you look at everything that I've talked about here and with the partnership committee and the construction advisory committee heading in this 10-foot direction, which the industry, the steel erection industry, was not a part of these two committees, this last sentence, discuss what can be done to ensure proper attendance at these meetings, to me is saying let's make sure that we got enough people there in opposition to add credit to our imposing this 10-foot across the board rule. On December 31st, 2002, we received notice of proposed rule changes from Oregon OSHA with public hearings scheduled January 29th and 31st, 2002. I attended both public hearings. At the first meeting, there was approximately 80 rank-and-file iron workers in attendance, all in support of adopting the federal rules. With the exception of one man, everyone who testified in opposition had never worked as an ironworker. I believe they may have had good intentions, but without first-hand knowledge of ironwork, they are attempting to impose an unsafe workplace without even realizing it. The one man who had worked as an ironworker was a safety director, was the director of safety and training representing LPR Construction. He seemed quite proud of the fact in 11 years, 26 employees fell while employed by LPR. But because of the company's 6-foot fall protection standard, all avoided serious injury or death. My immediate thought was, what kind of safety program allows on average one man to fall every 6 months? I wondered how many of those falls were caused by an employee tripping over their fall protection. Incidentally, LPR Construction was a member of the CINRAC committee in Washington, D.C. August 2nd, 2002, we received notice of the final rule adoption effective July 19th, 2002. In addition, Oregon OSHA's decision not to adopt 1926.754 paragraph C, 1, I, and double I, shear lug connectors and other similar devices create an unsafe work environment because it is one more thing that the connector has to contend with while receiving suspended loads. The reason the federal rule eliminated shear lugs is because they are a tripping hazard. Apparently, Oregon OSHA feels it is okay to trip and fall because of these devices as long as you are tied off. Oregon's Rule 473-003-0754 shear connector says, 1, must be guarded against the hazard of impalement, and 2, where the shear connector creates a tripping hazard, employees must be protected from falls to lower levels. Again, there is exposure to serious injury sustained by iron workers falling and hitting the structure before the fall arrest system stops the descent. Oregon OSHA has effectively created an unsafe work environment by their failure to adopt 1926.754. I want to draw your attention to the photograph that I put into your packet. Mm-hmm. This is a photo of a bridge I got out of the Oregonian. Now, you can see in the foreground on those bridge girders, those studs sticking up, those are shear lug connectors. The federal rule eliminates shear lug connectors, and you can see that the worker there has a lanyard, and he's tied off to a cable that goes parallel with the girder, and he's hoisting out a work platform from in between the two girders, and he's signaling the crane to get up on the load. As the basket comes up, and it can get hung up and pop and spring and kind of go wild, you can see that guy standing right amongst all those shear lug connectors. If anything were to happen, he has no escape. He's going to trip, he's going to fall, and most likely, on that, if he's lucky, he'll just break an ankle because of being entwined in those studs. But even so, if he does fall, which is very likely with all the tripping hazards there, he's going to be hurt. There's no doubt about it. And in addition to this, gentlemen, what CINRAC, the federal rule, states is that Okay, in between these two girders where that platform is coming out, we'll eventually have a wooden platform in there, concrete form essentially, to be stripped out later once the concrete's poured. It is only until that wooden temporary platform is in there that then the iron workers would come in and shoot those studs once they had, and then the handrails would be up and they would have a safe environment to work. This here is not a safe environment, and this by Oregon OSHA adopted, or not choosing not to adopt that part of the CENRAC proposal has really created, in my estimation, an unsafe environment. I am convinced that Oregon OSHA intentionally misled the real stakeholders in this rulemaking ruse by leading other committees unfamiliar with steel erection and putting the onus on those committees. I do not believe that is how the rulemaking process is supposed to work. CENRAC and federal OSHA are right. As an iron worker, I know from personal experience that when you tie off connectors, you are imposing an unsafe work environment. The federal rule allows the connector to decide whether or not to tie off below 30 feet. Connectors need freedom of movement when engaged in steel erection so they are able to freely approach or get out of the way of suspended loads. Tying off prevents this from occurring. I have had several close calls due to fall protection equipment where suspended loads have nearly knocked me off of the working surface because I was unable to simply move out of the way. I have had suspended loads snag my fall protection equipment and had to really bear down to overcome the drift of a 3,000-pound beam to keep it from dragging me off the steel. The people who think that the 10-foot rule is good for connectors would undoubtedly say that the fall protection I was wearing would prevent me from falling to a lower level. However, because these same people have never engaged in a task, they cannot see past their opinion. The point is that the very equipment that is designed to protect iron workers can cause serious injuries to connectors. In fact, when a connector is forced to tie off, it actually causes an enormous feeling of insecurity and vulnerability, especially when suspended loads are coming in. So in reality, at times, an iron worker's survival instinct will force us to circumvent our fall protection equipment. When it comes to decking, it was learned in CENRAC negotiations that many of the accidents occurred to employees that were not doing leading edge work. They wandered into the area and were consequently were injured. The federal rule eliminates this from occurring by establishing a controlled decking zone. No one can go into a controlled decking zone without fall protection except for the workers who are doing the deck installation. They are not required to use fall protection below 30 feet. The criteria for a controlled decking zone is spelled out in the final rule. One only has to read the preamble to the federal rule to understand the thoroughness of CENRAC committee negotiations to see that they truly came up with a set of rules that protect employees engaged in steel erection. Now I'm going to wrap this up in summary. I want to read you an excerpt out of the preamble. OSHA agrees with CENRAC that steel erection activities are different from most other construction activities. The different trigger height reflects these differences. OSHA also agrees with CENRAC that the former fall protection rules relating to steel erection are insufficiently protective and need to be strengthened. In examining the issues of the threshold height for requiring conventional fall protection, CENRAC considered 29 CFR 1926 subpart M, the general fall protection standard for construction in general. The subpart M trigger height for fall protection is 6 feet. CENRAC evaluated whether the trigger height in steel erection should be different than that in subpart M and concluded that it needed to be higher. Steel erection differs from general construction in three major respects: the narrowness of the working surface, the beam, its relationship above rather than below the rest of the structure, because we're creating something where something has never existed before, and a minimum distance of approximately 15 feet to the next lower level. In short, a new very narrow working surface is constantly being created as skeletal steel is erected at various heights. For many steel erectors, especially connectors, the work stops at the top level of the structure. House Bill 3010 is the vehicle that will assure a safe work environment for construction workers involved with steel erection. We urge your support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I know you've worked very hard on this, and we appreciate your very complete testimony. Bob and James, if you could, we're going to start timing.
Sure, I'll keep my marks.
If you could do 2 minutes.
James Watts, I'm the administrator
of the Northwest Pine Worker Employers Association. This is a regional association of steel erection contractors and general contractors that do their own steel erection work in Oregon, Washington, and Montana. The association supports House Bill 3010. Jeff walked you through the process. The association's been involved in the process. It's now gone on for some 5 or 6 years, federal level and then at the state level. This was the first example of what they call negotiated rulemaking, and it was initiated by Joe Deere from the state of Washington when he was head of federal OSHA. And the effort was to bring all the interested parties into the room to develop a new federal steel erection standard. There were representatives from the Associated General Contractors, and the Associated Builders and Contractors, various erector association groups, a National Erectors Association, the Ironworkers Union, and some of the other representatives of employees and insurance industry, etc. It was a long process that tried to take a comprehensive look at the hazards of the steel erection industry. And a similar process, as Jeff said, was followed in Oregon, at least to a point. I think it's important to realize that steel erection has been recognized as a distinct area of the construction industry. It has its own subpart in the safety code. And I think it's fair to say that ironworkers doing steel erection work face some unique hazards that other members of the building trades don't. Construction's a hazardous occupation, but for the erectors and for the men that make the initial connections high in the air, there's some unique hazards. Because of this, in the past, Oregon OSHA recognized the uniqueness of this particular trade, and they had different heights. As Jeff said, that the height for commercial construction for fall protection was 6 feet off the ground, basically. But for steel erection, it was 10 feet, and for connectors, 25. So there's been a recognition in the past that there's some unique issues here. Now, there are a lot of people in this room, and I know a lot of them. I know they're dedicated safety professionals. I know there are general contractors, representatives here, and they come from companies that have outstanding safety records. And I know there's a real commitment from all these people toward employee safety. And I think there's some disagreement. I think there's an argument that can be made for a uniform fall protection height. But I think that's overcome by the unique hazards in the steel erection industry. I think that the state of Oregon can essentially have both. The new federal steel erection standard has been adopted throughout the United States. I talked to a large steel erector from California at a national meeting about a month ago, and he said California, Cal OSHA, had adopted the CENRAC rules. We, in the industry, think it's important that Oregon join into this uniform approach and take advantage of a lot of common training opportunities, and I honestly believe this will enhance employee safety. So because of that, we support the adoption of House Bill 3010. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bob.
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief. I'm Bob Shiprack, representing the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. We strongly endorse House Bill 3010. Jeff has adequately brought you through this process that the adoption of the federal OSHA standard would, for steel erection. I've been in the building 20 years and never saw anything quite like this. So that's part of the reason we're here. We represent the skilled trades, and it's not because we got a copyright on that. We have apprenticeship programs. All of our trades are different. We are trained to do our jobs in a safe fashion, and we have varying trigger heights for fall protections. If you've gone scaffold on your ladder, those are the first things we're taught. As a journeyman electrician, I was part of the reason I'm concerned about this is I'm wondering if people outside of my industry will next start saying that we shouldn't work with live voltages or something like that because we might get shocked. I'm sorry, we're trained to do that. That's our jobs, and erecting steel in a safe fashion is what iron workers do. Jim hit on it. The whole point of the contention that I found so bizarre is he mentioned the current rule was 25 feet for these people. Federal OSHA said 30, and frankly it was because building floors are getting bigger to put more mechanical systems in. And what happened is they took them down to 10, so it went completely counter to what Federal OSHA was talking about at all. One of the things we've tried to do in the building the last decade at least that I'm very proud of is that the legislatures recognize that when labor and management can agree on something, then it's probably a good idea to let them go with it instead of fighting it out on the floors of the legislature. And believe me, I've seen those, and they're not pretty. And here you've got a situation where the employers of iron workers and the iron workers themselves agree on something that's safe for their workplace. These employers have the highest workers' comp costs in the industry. They have some of the highest liability costs. Do you think for a second that they're going to endorse something that's going to raise those costs? Of course not. There has been some precedent about putting rules in the statute, and someone may mention that. I was a party in my industry several sessions ago. Instead of going with an administrative rule for our utility linemen, there was a threat that there would be a requirement that utility linemen use what we call bare hands and rubber gloves on high voltages. We limited the law we passed. I carried the bill, said we can use bare hands and rubber gloves up to 5,000 volts. We're trained to do, but if you get so far, you know, it gets really dangerous. And we put that in the statute in order to protect our workers. So there is a precedent for putting things in the ORSs. And last but not least, and I don't think this was mentioned, if a contractor or owner chooses to do something less than the federal OSHA rule, they can do that. So I wanted the committee to understand that if they want to go to 6, 10, whatever, they have that right. And what we want to do is adopt the federal rule simply. And but if other people are free to choose that. I'll just stop with that. And again, just reiterate that our trades are very unique, very specialized, and we're highly skilled and trained in it. And thank goodness there's a legislature to come to deal with this problem.
Thank you very much. We'll take that as a compliment.
It is.
We're not going to go to questions panel because we have committee because we have so many people that are waiting to testify. So we will. I'm sure Bob will be around the building and we can ask him questions if we can get through all of this. Thank you. We're going to call up a group opposing now. It's Ed Glad of the Carpenters, Bill Walden, Washington County Carpenters, and Al Aguadas from Beaverton. We're going to give you 2 minutes each.
Thank you, Representative Close. My name is Ed Glad. I work for the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. I've been a carpenter for 20 years. I've worked on bridge structures, structures where we also put buildings into place and components of buildings into place where there were nothing before. We work under cranes, and I think that if you can follow the testimony of the predecessors who were up at this table here, you would have the impression that fall protection has been around for a long time. It's actually a relatively new beast in the industry for us to be able to deal with. And in fact, I know that Representative Schaffler and I worked on buildings at the Intel plant where it was very early on where we were required to wear fall protection. And there was a lot of constructionese that described the process of getting used to pulling this lanyard or yo-yo or whatever the term you wanted to use for this fall protection, and we had to adapt our understanding as to what the process, what the speed, and what the capacities were of using that new fall protection in the evolution of construction. This is not something that is going to go away, and the reality is that the description that you're receiving from the iron workers is that fall protection is not necessary because it is involving steel. In the same environment where you would be allowing wood to be joined to another component in the building at the same heights, we as carpenters would be required to wear the fall protection, but the iron workers wouldn't. The same distance of fall is going to have the same effect on the body when it lands. And so in that sense, we oppose having multiple standards here in Oregon for our work crews to work side by side with other folks that have a different standard. And so I'll turn it over to Mr. Walden here.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Walden. I'm a field representative with the Pacific Northwest District Council of Carpenters. I'm also a member of the OSHA Partnership Committee and the OR-OSHA Construction Advisory Committee. I wish to speak against House Bill 3010. I'm concerned of the effect of this bill will have on the carpenters on the job sites. In the following, I'll outline my objections. In particular, I object to the changes made in subsection 2, subsection C. First and most important, the change and or addition in that subsection was previously addressed by OR-OSHA and went through the full review process with public hearings such as we attend today. As a result of that process, OR-OSHA adopted a uniform trigger height for fall protection for all trades. By trigger height, I mean a certain height requirement where fall protection is required. House Bill 3010 is an attempt to circumvent the OR-OSHA regulatory process. As I mentioned, I'm a member of the OR-OSHA Partnership and Construction Advisory Committees. Both of these groups were unanimous in their opposition to the standard in House Bill 3010 and in support of a uniform height requirement for fall protections for all workers in Oregon. As I'm sure you will hear today, safety professionals in Oregon are in support of the OR-OSHA uniform standard for fall protection. If House Bill 3010 was adopted, we would have two separate trigger heights for fall protection. I believe this would create confusion about the requirements for fall protection on construction projects. A uniform trigger point leaves no doubt when a worker, whether it be an iron worker, a carpenter, electrician, pipe fitter, needs to have fall protection. Similarly, I do not feel it is proper to dictate rules for safety based on the material used in the construction of a building. The standard referred to in House Bill 3010 would allow connectors and deckers installing steel products a higher trigger point than other workers in construction projects. Carpenters build structures out of wood using wood posts and wood beams. They also use plywood decking. Many times these structural elements are connected with bolts and metal hanging brackets, as are steel posts and beams. The weights of these structures are comparable, and the lifting devices, cranes, forklifts, etc., are similar. The plywood decking is now commonly installed in 8x10 sheets, which presents similar logistic problems to steel decking. The fall hazard is the same, so my question is, why should the requirement for fall protection change due to the material used? The workers of both trades will suffer either death or severe disability from a fall over 10 feet. A uniform trigger point for fall protection is safe for all workers. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Al.
Welcome. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Al Arguedas. I'm a certified safety professional with 28 years of experience. Currently, I'm employed as the safety director for Skanska USA Oregon Division, formerly Baugh Construction Company. And We're taken a little bit by surprise by this. We just found out yesterday about this hearing, and so we're reacting. But we've been involved very closely with the process of this subpart R that's being referred to. Skeska USA opposes the HB 3010. The basis for Skeska's opposition to this amendment is one of concern for safety and health of the affected workers, primarily on workers. We're charged, myself and my company, with protecting the lives of our workers in the workforce, in the workplace, including these gentlemen behind me. Skeska is a commercial building contractor that frequently contracts with steel erectors to execute that phase of construction on its projects. As a construction manager and or general contractor, Skeska has a moral obligation and legal responsibility to ensure the safety and health of all workers on the job site, including those employed by subcontractors. 3 million man hours last year, $300 million in volume. Our safety performance rate exceeds that of the average state rate for construction, which is around 9.0. Our rate is about 1.5 for 3 million hours worked last year. We're always striving for an injury-free workplace. By adopting subpart R as referenced in HB 3010, Oregon would be, in essence, be taking a step backwards in safety, nullifying a safer version of subpart R already in effect and currently being enforced by Oregon OSHA. To lend clarity to this issue, the history of subpart R must be taken into consideration. I know that's been discussed at length, but for the record, Department of Labor chartered CENRAC, comprised of members from the business, labor, professional, regulatory community. CENRAC's mission was to explore and develop improved safety and health regulations to govern the construction industry steel erection process. Long overdue has already been heard. After several years of study, discussion, and negotiation, CENRAC developed a proposed set of standards, and that was adopted by federal OSHA and became effective as law in January 2002. Per Fed OSHA directives, Oregon OSHA had 6 months to adopt the new rules as written or with amendments to enhance the rules, not minimize them or lessen them, but to enhance the rules, thereby exceeding Fed OSHA minimum requirements. Oregon OSHA, the most progressive state and health regulatory agency in the nation, chose to exercise its right to amend subpart R as permissible by federal OSHA. Again, enhancing the standard, not lessening it. Led by Oregon OSHA Administrator Pete DeLuca, an Oregon task force was formed to determine what, if any, changes to Fed OSHA subpart R were warranted. The task force, which was comprised of business, labor, and Oregon OSHA representatives to include ironworkers, Local 29, met for several months and concluded by adopting 7 additional rules, again, exceeding the federal standard. With the exception of one item, there was full task force consensus on the proposed amendments. The gentlemen before us, Jeff Carlson, Jim Watts, Mr. Shiprack, expressed their concern with this, and the ironworkers were adamantly opposed to Oregon OSHA's decision not to adopt Fed OSHA's rules contained in paragraphs 1926.760 B and C. Specifically, the federal rules allow for steel erection connectors and deckers to work without fall protection up to a height of 30 feet. Instead of the 30-foot rule, Oregon OSHA, being more progressive, requires that all construction workers, steel erection connectors, and deckers included, work with the benefit of fall protection at heights of 10 feet or greater. The ironworkers, as you know, voiced their opposition to this. Yet, you know, this rule is...
You'll need to summarize. We're out of time.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
That's okay. I'll allow you a few closing remarks.
The truth is, we need to go on record as opposing House Bill 3010 in the interest of safety for the worker.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to go to our next panel. It's Pete DeLuca, Joe Miller, Jessica Harris. Good morning, and if you can confine your remarks to 2 minutes each, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I'll start out. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter DeLuca. I'm the administrator of Oregon OSHA. I've provided some written testimony. I'll briefly summarize it for the record in the interest of time. First, I think it's important
here that we separate the substantive issues, which we understand this bill to address, from the issues of form, which this bill also raises. As to the substance, we understand the proponents to be primarily interested in the height at which employees engaged in connecting structural steel in construction must use a safety device of fall protection. Currently, as has been indicated, the federal rules provide that employees engaged in this activity must tie off or use the fall protection at a height of 30 feet. Oregon rules, and I might add Washington, is the same, require a tie-off at the height of 10 feet. On this substantive issue, 30 feet versus 10 feet or anything else, in this process, Oregon OSHA is neutral. Last year, we adopted the 10-foot rule. There was much testimony both ways, and you see evidence of it here today. We made a very difficult decision based upon the record and based upon our view of the record as a whole as it was presented to us. Our decision is one on which reasonable people can differ, and certainly there are differences of opinion. And now the issue has been brought here for a fresh look, and for this reason, in this process, we are neutral on this substantive issue. It is with the form of this legislation that we do have a problem in two respects. First, we believe that issues such as this are best dealt with in rulemaking. Administrative rules can change to adapting circumstances, and it's much harder to do this with statute. And for this reason, this is why we have administrative rules. We can go back through an administrative rulemaking process and take a second look at this in the event that there are reasons to do so. And certainly there's a process by which anybody can request that we open rulemaking, and we would do that. Secondly, the second problem that we have with form, because the way this bill is written, it raises more questions than it really answers. The bill says that our rules shall conform to the regulations in 29 CFR Part 19, 26 Subpart R. We just call it Subpart R, which is a fairly lengthy and complex document. This is Subpart R. This we got from Federal OSHA's website. You can get it too. It's got a great many different things which it addresses. And because it says our rules shall conform to those regulations, we're in a quandary if this were to pass as to what that really means. Does this require the adoption of Subpart R in its entirety? Could Oregon adopt Subpart R and then adopt other rules as well, in addition, that have to do with steel erection? What if, after adopting Subpart R, we got together with labor and business and everybody agreed that it wasn't working? We couldn't change it because it would be a matter of statute. We'd have to come back to the legislature for that. And what if the federal government changes Subpart R? When we adopt it, do we have to adopt it as it is written, or do we adopt it as it may change over the course of time? We simply don't know the answers to these questions. And the wording of the statute leaves this very much in doubt. We would prefer, if we're going to have a statute, to see specific language which addresses the concerns that the proponents have. A statute, for example, which says 30 feet instead of 10 foot, instead of just Subpart R. And then the legislature could truly focus on what the problem is and could make its decision, and up or down, one way or the other, as we've already done. And all affected parties in the future would be clear as to exactly what that meant. So those are our two major major form concerns, and on the substance, again, we are neutral.
Thank you, Mr. DeLuca. That was very helpful.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Miller, Safety and Loss Control Manager for the Associated General Contractors. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in opposition to House Bill 3010. The state of Oregon has long had a history of being at the leading edge in workplace safety and health. The Oregon Columbia chapter of AGC believes that, in part, that it is in part because of that partnership that they have been developed between Oregon OSHA and businesses that they regulate. Consequently, when Oregon OSHA opened its rulemaking process to adopt federal OSHA's steel erection rules, AGC petitioned and provided formal testimony for OSHA not to adopt those rules by reference. While AGC felt that most of the new rules would provide a positive benefit for workers in the state of Oregon, there were some portions that we felt would move Oregon backward and lessen the safety of workers. Of particular concern was moving the trigger height for fall protection for iron workers from the existing 10 feet up to 15 feet for steel erection activities and up to 30 feet for connectors. AGC felt that this exposes iron workers to serious and fatal falls unnecessarily, as it has been a common practice in Oregon for many years for fall protection to be mandatory at either the 6 or 10 foot heights. AGC therefore agrees with OSHA's adoption of the steel erection standard, Division 3R, which includes a uniform 10-foot fall protection requirement for all construction activities. Conversely, we strongly oppose adopting federal OSHA's Subpart R rules being proposed in House Bill 3010. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members,
if you could summarize and not repeat, we'd appreciate it.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. And speaking on behalf of the industry, we are responsible broadly for the safety of our workers. We're the ones that carry the workers' comp insurance, and we want to make sure that everyone walks home at the end of the day safe. We appreciate that the iron workers have their perspective, but at the end of the day, it's our responsibility to ensure the entire job is safe and secure. And we believe that adopting a standard at 30 feet puts workers at risk. You drop from 29 and a half feet to the ground, and the potential chance of injury, death, or not being able to ever walk again is severe. And we don't believe that that's in the best interest of our workers, and certainly not in the best interest of the industry. We strongly urge you to oppose this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your brevity. We're going to go to the next panel. It's Dave Parsons, Dan Hartman, with Hoffman, Lisa Trussell. And committee, I intend to go right up to the lunch hour. Hope you will be able to bear with me. We should be through this testimony by 10-2 and then go to our work session. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. Lisa couldn't stay for the rest of the hearing, and Dan Harmon is here as our spokesperson and such.
Great. I'll get started. My name is Dan Harmon. I'm Vice President, General Counsel of Hoffman Corporation, the parent company of the Hoffman Construction Companies of Oregon. Hoffman is one of the largest general contractors in the West Coast, the largest general contractor in Oregon. We employ between 2,500 and 10,000 workers. Construction workers in on our Oregon sites. I'm here today, and I want to talk about my motivation because someone asked about that. I'm here because, as Representative Close said in the last the work session, that we must act if something devastating is about to happen, and something devastating is about to happen. I'm here because I've had the unfortunate responsibility of having to stand over the body of a dead iron worker and talk to his family about why we couldn't save him. That's a very emotional experience when that happens, and it transforms your thinking about these issues greatly. I'm here because falls from heights are the leading cause of death and serious injury in the building industry. I'm here because people are going to die if this bill is passed. I'm here because I believe this bill is ill-provident and irresponsible. I'm not here because there's some competitive advantage. Hoffman Construction Company has a mandatory fall protection standard of anyone who is over 6 feet will tie off. Does that put us at a competitive disadvantage? Absolutely. That's how important it is. Because people are going to die. What's illogical about the, I'm here because the rule that the feds have is somewhat illogical. And you have to think about it this way. Under 30 feet, you're not required to tie off, but over 30 feet, you are. Now, how many of us think that you're less likely to die, that much less likely to die, from a fall under 30 feet than you are over 30 feet? It's illogical. We've had people die, and what was the genesis of our rule of 6 foot was in 1985, we had a gentleman fall off a wall form, 8 feet, hit the back of his head, and die. It doesn't take much. We're fragile people. Oregon has always had a high standard. We're lowering the safety bar. You're also here talking about who is going to be responsible. Under Oregon law, the Employers Liability Act exists. Many may be familiar with that. It requires a general contractor to be responsible for safety in the workplace. It requires a general contractor to use every device practicable to prevent injury. The legislature is being asked in this bill to step in and say, well, wait a minute. We're going to take your decision-making out of your hands, and we're going to say they don't have to tie off up to 30 feet. There are some myths. I'm here because there's some myths. There are some myths that tie off costs lives. I'm here to tell you that in the last 7 years, we have had 7 people who are alive today because of fall protection. 7 people that have come off of our buildings at heights in the general range that we're talking about that are here on this earth today alive. 4 of those were iron workers. 3 of them were connectors. 1 of them was a decking worker. So iron workers come off steel. The other myth is that tie-off is time-consuming and costs money. That's not true. I've given you some photos, and it's kind of interesting for you to look at those photos. I hope you have them in front of you. The first one is of a connector who's unhooking rigging and the hook from a piece of steel. Notice he's tied off. Notice all the blue sky around him. Imagine how safe that is if there's no tie-off, or unsafe. The second page is 2 connectors working on a beam. You can obviously see that they're height. There's an elevation below them. What if one of those were to slip and to fall? Do you believe that they would be uninjured without tie-off? The third photo is much higher than 30 feet. But what's interesting about it is, look at the fall protection system and how it's not that inconvenient for folks. And it goes to the issue I have of the illogical nature of the federal standard. The people that you see there at top are above, well above 30 feet. But you see the web core down below, that's below 30 feet. So those people would be tied off, and the people below them, if they were connecting steel, wouldn't be tied off. I'm certain that if either one of them weren't tied off and fell, they would probably not be able to continue working if they survived. The final photo is a crew of glaziers. Now, we're talking about ironwork. These are glaziers that are putting the glazing on the canopy out at the Portland Airport. There's a couple things interesting about this photo. First, everyone is tied off. Second, they're working at the leading edge, is what... if you look at the federal rule, if these were decking installers, they would be working at the leading edge, and they possibly could not be tied off. The thing that's more interesting for you is one of those individuals is alive today because he had fall protection on. He fell through one of those holes. He was suspended. He was pulled up and survived. Had he not been tied off, he would have impacted the implaning roadway, which is where we all offload our luggage, and probably been dead and seriously injured.
And David, what was the height of this picture?
It varies in height. At one edge, in about this area, it's about, from the implaning roadway, is about 30 feet, and then at the top it goes up to about 40 feet. So it varies, but the concept is still the same.
Okay. We are out of time, so okay. Could you summarize?
I will summarize. What I'm asking this committee to do is to not approve this bill. Let's do the responsible thing. Let's save iron workers' lives, and let's make Oregon continue to be a safe place.
Thank you. Oh, that's Dave. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm Dave.
I'm sorry. That was Dan Harmon. Dave.
Good Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name, for the record, is David Parsons. I'm a private safety consultant. I've been involved in construction safety and health since 1978-79, so I've seen a bunch of different changes in regulations, and I have investigated many accidents, including six fatalities, which the latest one was last July. I'm here to testify in opposition of House Bill 3010 on twofold, as a private consultant and also a member of ASSE, which is American Society of Safety Engineers. Currently, I'm president-elect of the largest chapter on the West Coast, Region 1, Columbia Willamette, based in Portland, soon to be installed as president of the chapter in June. Before you, you have a letter that was drafted by Bruce Poinsett. He is our governmental affairs chairperson for our chapter. Him and I put this letter together in opposition. The Columbia Willamette chapter, in conjunction with Region 1, which comprises Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California, Hawaii, and the Tahoe area, at the American Society of Safety Engineers, would like to go on the record in opposition to the proposed changes in Oregon Revised Statute 654.025. The society was established in 1911, American Society of Safety Engineers, and has in excess of 30,000 occupational safety and health members. They have dedicated themselves to ensuring that workplaces are safe, healthy, and protected from the environmental risk. Our membership supported Oregon OSHA's initiation of the changes made to the Construction Safety Code, Subpart R, Steel Erection, and also Subpart M, Fall Protection, as a means to further define the safety consideration during the planning and construction of structural steel buildings. Many of our members voiced concerns, and just in our chapter alone, we have just under 500 members, voiced their concerns because of the number of iron workers that have fallen to their death in recent years. We feel that this bill erodes the proactive steps that Oregon OSHA has taken to protect workers. And being in safety many years and involved in many different states, Oregon OSHA has taken the leadership and the steps to be proactive and not reactive. And this letter is signed off by Bruce Poinsett, myself, and then Brian Clark, which is the safety director for Hoffman Construction. Brian is also our regional vice president for Region 1 for American Society of Safety Engineers. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen. We're going to go to our last panel. It's John Carlson, Neil Crocker, Andrew Winters. And these are all iron workers. And you have about 2 minutes each.
Pardon?
You have about 2 minutes each.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Neil Crocker. I'm an iron worker of 30 years out of Local 29. I'm here today to urge your support for the bill, for House Bill 3010. Since 1973, I've worked as an iron worker in the states of Florida, Indiana, Idaho, North Dakota, Nevada, California, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. I've worked on nuclear power plants, hydroelectric dams, radar towers, high-rise buildings, sports arenas, convention centers, bridges, and many other structures. I have been as high as 485 feet in the air and 100 foot below the water in cofferdams. I've worked at nearly all aspects of the trade. I feel I have enough experience at my chosen trade, which is iron work, to address the issues of job safety. I support the CENRAC proposal 29 CFR Part 1926 Subpart R Safety Standards for Steel Erection, Final Rule. The fall protection trigger height for connectors is essential to their safety. It affords them freedom of movement to get away from fast-moving objects such as bundles of decking and structural steel pieces that are suspended by a crane. I know of several occasions that if I were tied off 100% of the time, I would either be dead or crippled. So I cheated and took the chance of being fired for a safety violation. The current rules force you to cheat. It's ironic, but there are times when you must unhook your safety line so you can escape injury and that you can get fired for it. Please support HB 3010. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Carlson. I'm a
30-year member of Iron Workers 29, and I am here today in support of House Bill 3010. For the last several years, our trade has been under pressure from people outside the steel erection industry. They impose safety rules on us that create unsafe jobs. Recently, OSHA has proposed rule changes that is like a stranglehold. It seems they just ignore our industry by lumping us together with the rest of the trades. Federal OSHA understands that steel erection is unique and general safety rules that are good for plumbers, electricians, and other crafts can be hazardous to us. Federal safety standards, steel erection, at House HB 3010, delivered to Oregon, will improve job safety for ironworkers. These rules are developed over many years and are tailor-made for steel erection. I know that the Employers Association wants this, and so do we. I primarily run jobs. It is very frustrating to me as an ironworker to send ironworkers up on the steel knowing that my hands are tied with guns and their safety. I urge you to support HB 3010.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrew Winters. I'm a member of Ironworkers Local 29 of Portland, Oregon. I have been employed in the ironworking industry for 7 years. I have been fortunate to be fully employed for the last 7 years and have worked on some major steel erection projects throughout the state of Oregon, a few being a cogen in Boardman, a weapons incinerator in Umatilla, and a cogen in Klamath Falls. My interest in the adoption of CENRAC stems from witnessing an experience I had while working for Reef Erection on Dornbecker's Children's Hospital. Hoffman was the general. On this project, a number of columns were designed to be welded to the beams they sat upon. A connector was sitting on a beam. It was also tied off to that same beam with a 4 or 6 foot lanyard. Something happened there trying to pull the column over. A weld broke that held the column. The connector realized that the column and the beam were going over, tried to jump to another beam, but was tied off to the beam he was sitting on. Therefore, he had to ride that beam down. If he had the flexibility to determine whether to tie off or not in that situation, he would have avoided injury. I hope you can support House Bill 3010 as it is proposed by the people who do the work every day, and I know what it takes to keep us safe. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. That concludes our witnesses on this bill. Committee, I think we can see there's strong feelings on both sides. I think we need time to digest all of this testimony that we've been given. So I'm not going to go to work session today on this bill, and we will intend to bring it back and to keep talking about this subject. Thank you for everyone who came. Appreciate your testimony. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3010. I'm going to open a work session. 2230. And that is the slamming bill. And committee, you have a dash 5 amendment.
Dash 4. Excuse
me, the dash 4 amendment. Do you have the dash 4?
There are no dash 4.
No dash 5? You just fixed it up.
Right, they took the part 5.
Okay. It's the dash 4 amendment that's before you. And we also have a dash 1. I'm going to call forward Richard Kosiasen. Is he in the room?
Shelly Jensen.
Excuse me. Welcome, Shelley. Thank you for your patience. If you could go ahead and present this to us.
Okay.
And the staff, I guess we don't need to read the summary because we've already visited this several times in hearing. Go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, the dash 4s are the same as the dash 3s from the last meeting, except that Section 5 has been omitted. And Section 5 was the section that talked about the exclusive remedy at the PUC. So that's no longer in the bill. This just talks about mirroring the FCC rules and that it doesn't apply to wireless carriers. And I think, as far as I know, everyone's okay with these amendments, both the carriers and the PUC.
Richard, would you come forward? Can you address the dash four amendments also?
Madam Chair, Richard Kosasan with Verizon Wireless. Dash four amendments, I think, meet the concerns that were raised at the previous meeting, specifically with the deletion of Section 5. And we would be fine with these amendments as proposed.
Okay. Are there other questions for these two?
Just clarification. Thank you, Madam Chair. Shelley, my understanding is with this amendment, the bill would just transfer to the PUC the authority to regulate in the area of slamming, would not take away any of the current ability of any other agency to deal with the
Chair,
problem.
Representative Rosenbaum, that's my understanding as well, that the PUC would be able to investigate individual complaints, but it wouldn't keep the Attorney General's office, for example, from bringing some sort of an action based on a large number of complaints under the unfair trade practices.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Gallegos.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the dash four amendments to House Bill 2230.
Representative Gallegos moves the dash four amendments into House Bill 2230. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Gallegos.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2230 as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 2230 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
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 Is in process of coming. He is excused. Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2230 goes to the House floor. And Representative Merkley, would you like to carry this?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 2230. Open a work session on House Bill 2639. Call forward Harlan Levy and Chana Jarvis. And committee, you have an amendment that addressed the concerns of the committee about this real estate earnest money. The dash one amendment. And please explain it to us. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors. The Dash 1 amendment before you addresses the concerns that were raised by Representative Merkley as well as Mr. Monroe from the escrow companies. We appreciate them pointing out some deficiencies in the original bill. Those were not our intention, and we have restored the bill, the statute, to the way that it was prior to our amendment, which will just be adding a new section to the bill. So as you can see, the information that would have been deleted is restored, and the new information that would have been added is taken out. Just gets us back to the status quo with respect to interest that can be generated on these accounts. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Harlan? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure my understanding is correct. Under the provisions as restored, an individual who puts their money in trust could still arrange for that to receive that interest, even though that's not explicitly laid out in the language of the statutes.
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Thank you very much. Representative Gallego.
So, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2639.
Representative Gallegos moves the Dash 1 amendment into House Bill 2639. Is there discussion? Is there objection? So ordered. Representative Gallegos.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2639 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 2639 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to note that in many transactions right now, the interest simply goes to the banks, if you will. People aren't aware of their ability to arrange to receive the interest. And so this is kind of taking a resource and channeling it towards low-income and first-time home buyers. It's not an enormous resource, but I think, if I recall right, that Jenna heard about this idea at a conference and thought that that'd be useful to do in Oregon. And I think it is in fact one of those situations where we're not going to change the world, but we're going to affect some families, and each and every family affected will be affected in a very positive way. And so I support this bill and appreciate bringing the idea here. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gaitos?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Pitts?
Is excused.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair
Clement? Votes aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2639 moves to the floor. And I need a carrier. Who's the sponsor of that bill?
Crummell?
Is it Crummell?
Yeah.
Okay. We will give that to Representative Crummell for hearing. So I'll close the work session on 2639. Thank you, committee, for bearing with us an extra half an hour. I appreciate your hard work, and may you have a good weekend. We are adjourned.